Marin. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Okay, that's it. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking but saddened conservatives. Thank God they're sad. I am appreciating that. Also, I'd just like to welcome aboard all you progressives who think civil rights is how you treat your nanny. How are you guys doing? Do you know what I mean? That's what it's devolved to, isn't it? Just money and nannies and people who think they're doing the right thing out of shame. That is not values. That is just self-hatred manifesting itself as liberalism. I'm done with it. Anyways, how you doing, Mark Riley?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I stayed up all night. You know why? I didn't stay up all night, but I was up a little later than necessary because I said, hey, you know, I could go to sleep now or worry. How about that? They're my choices. Why don't I do that? You know what the new worry is? What if the crap does hit the fan and I've got to move my cats? Uh-oh. How is that a problem? I'm sitting here thinking like the world is ending on some level. There's politics to be thought about. There's things in the world that are pressing. But I'm like, oh man, do I put them all in a box? Do I drive them? Do I buy a cat caravan? How do I move my circus back to L.A. if need be? That's my big problem of the evening. But there are bigger problems, so let's move into them if we can. What do you think, Riley?
Sure, why not?
Can I tell the people what we're going to be doing tomorrow? Because tomorrow's fun day. It's fun day. We'll be broadcasting live from Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District. Tomorrow morning, we'll have New York City Democratic mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer, who's got something to... He better have a good pitch, boy.
Hey.
Plus, Lawton Smalls will be there, Milf Cardinal Milfington. So come on down. We got free coffee, prizes, your favorite... I thought it said candy, but it says comedy. Maybe we'll have some candy. What are your favorite candies?
Really.
Yeah, what are your favorite candies? Why don't you tell us? It's Halloween's coming up. We'll bring a big bag of Hershey's Kisses and throw them at you. That's Restaurant Florent. That's on Ganzevoort Street in the Meatpacking District. If you get there early, you can ask. Maybe we'll have a. Can we do that? Can we ask Freddie a couple questions from the audience? I think we can.
I think we can accommodate that, Mark.
You know, because, I mean, I'll tell you, we're going to talk about this in a little while. Bloomberg's bumping the polls because of the terror threat level raising. It raises some serious questions as to whether there were discussions about whether or not raising it would have some political impact in terms of the campaign. We're going to get into that because, you know, somebody must have said something, but that's not the top story. The top story for me is that Bill Frist has been subpoenaed.
Yep.
Subpoenaed, my friends, by the SEC to turn over personal records and documents as part of a federal probe on his July sales of his family's company, HCA Inc., which is a for-profit hospital company. He's expected to testify under oath. All these Republicans testifying. Isn't that great? Just singing. Before he's going to have to testify about whether the company's financial health and what he knew about it in the weeks before he sold the stock. Now, this type of formal request for documents, apparently, as I was talking to you about before the show, means that they're coming in, they're honing in, right, Riley?
Yeah, they are. They are now trying to figure out if there's anything criminal that took place here. And, you know, Bill Frist's company, HCA, is a for-profit and apparently quite profitable company that Bill Frist supposedly put. Now, you know, there's a separate issue about his blind trust, which we talked about yesterday.
Well, we can rehash that a little bit. It shows that basically that Frist earned tens of thousands of dollars from a stock in HCA, the family-founded hospital chain. The stocks were controlled by his brother, and they were not in the blind trust that he said he knew nothing about.
No. And, of course, the one member of the SEC has recused himself from any dealings with Bill Frist. That's Christopher Cox, who's a former congressman from California, who apparently has very close ties to Bill Frist.
Does he have stock in HCA?
I wonder. You better call Tom Frist and find out, don't you think?
Let's get him on the phone.
But, I mean, at least, hey, give him some credit. He was honest. He recused himself. He's going to have nothing to do with this.
Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, being I don't know what the word is, but I'm learning things about politics every day. The SEC see, has to keep this personal. It has to focus on his personal finance because it is part of the executive branch, and it is prohibited from seeking documents or testimony that relates directly to legislative acts and the motivation for legislative acts. And that's interesting. So this is all going to be about Frist's personal finances and what that implies. What happens then, Riley, if the SEC finds out that he did indeed do some inside trading and that he's guilty of that? Does that mean that his legislative record comes into question and another investigation is done by another branch? Would that be a Justice Department investigation?
Well, yeah, I assume the SEC would have to turn over to an interested, and remember, I'm emphasizing the term interested, Justice Department, any documents they had that they thought might relate to criminal conduct. Now, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, can sanction Frist itself if they find that they violated or that Frist violated any SEC regulations. They can do, they can fine him or whatever. Yeah. They can't put him in jail.
Right.
They can certainly fine him and turn over whatever they have to another law enforcement agency or another agency, I shouldn't say, because the SEC is not law enforcement
sure,
per se.
Sure.
But turn it over to another agency if they think something criminal was done.
We can only hope, my friends, that Bill Frist is a criminal of the top notch. You know, a lot of progressives say, hey, why does Marin have to attack them like they attack us? Aren't we better than that? Yeah, maybe some of you are, but I'm not. Can I celebrate? Is that okay with me? Can I get a little anger buzz, a little Schadenfreude excitement, please? Thank you. The White House is saying that some Supreme Court nominees withdrew from consideration, but that apparently had nothing to do with Bush's nomination of Myers. That's what they're saying. That yes, some people bailed out because the nomination process was too grilling, too taxing. They don't want to be involved in it, and that had nothing to do with him deciding to nominate somebody who's completely incompetent, and all that he could really sell her on was the fact that she believes in Jesus in a very deep way.
We are seeing something amazing here, Mark. Uh-huh. We are seeing the White House's best efforts to try and mollify conservatives within their own base coming to virtually nothing as conservatives continue to pile on Harriet Myers. They just they don't believe that she should be the next Supreme Court nominee. Now, we should point out, and you know, at a point sometime in the near future, people are going to realize it's not up to the pundits. Bill Kristol doesn't decide whether Harriet Myers ends up being a Supreme Court justice, even though he says, and he's, of course, the editor of the Weekly Standard, that she should withdraw her own name from the nomination. That's just a suggestion. The people that will decide this, assuming it gets that far, will be the Senate Judiciary Committee and then the full Senate.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about William Kristol and, the Weekly Standard and the language that he used in sort of, introducing the idea that Harriet Myers should step down on her own volition. He says, and I'll quote his short piece from the Weekly Standard, quote, "There is no need now to elaborate on Bush's error," end quote. And let me just interject here. Why not? Do you know what I mean? Why, at this point in the game, would these guys who seek to protect Bush and put the onus on Harriet Myers, who has just been given the biggest opportunity of her life? It's because, and correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe we can have a discussion here about this, Riley, because I don't know. Is it because that they don't want complete lame duckness to overtake this president at this point in time because they still got to get a few miles out of him?
Bush is still a stubborn guy. Bush is going to stand by this woman until she no longer stands by herself. I think he's going to try and push it through. I'm not sure, and you know, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I'm not sure I would have even believed I could say this. But she may not make it.
Yeah. Well, it's just curious to me that they would call for her to take that action. And you're saying that's because they know that Bush is too stubborn to change his mind. But let's talk about the possibility that some of this momentum here. And the other thing that was admitted during this conservative attack is apparently the White House spokesman Scott McClellan copped to the fact that Christo fascist zombie brigade leader of the Focus on Family, James Dobson, they've substantiated his claim that he talked to Karl Rove and that Rove convinced him that Myers was the right pick. And I guess he convinced him just by the fact that she is evangelical and that she would do his bidding. I imagine there was other bartering going on because, Dobson is one of the only big religious leaders that has come out in support of this person. So I imagine that there was some other points that must have been made, like, maybe he was guaranteed some faith-based kickbacks or a seat at the big table. But I don't know. But getting back to the conservative attack on Bush's nominee. Why would they start to detach it from Bush himself, Riley? Just because that he's stubborn, or they need to use this guy?
Well, they are. See, Bush now is being whipsawed by a complete, well, not a completely different situation, but a parallel situation. Both Democrats and some on the right are beginning to criticize Bush for emphasizing Harriet Meyer's religion, this fact that she is a charismatic Christian, because they know that if he goes too far, the Senate Judiciary Committee will stop him in his tracks. They will not go for if Meyer steps over the line and people begin to think, particularly in Congress, that she has already formulated a position on Roe v. Wade, she's done. Yeah. No matter what else happens, she's done in committee.
And that seems like all he's been selling her on. And the basic fact of it is that even, you know, borderline religious fanatics know that this much emphasis placed on one individual's faith has nothing to do and no business in this Supreme Court nomination process. And it shouldn't have anything to do with who one nominates. I mean, that is a basic fact of what this is supposed to be about. And these conservatives are generally just pissed off because they've been waiting, you know, what, 20 years for this
longer
spot.
Than that. They have been waiting. This is their moment. From the day Barry Goldwater got beat in 1964, they have been planning for this. They have been building all of these different networks of conservative pundits and talk shows and magazines and newspapers. They have been building all of this to the day that they could influence American social political policy in this way, and they see it slipping through their grasp.
And also, you, as we speculated a little bit before we got on the air, you know, this might be the beginning of the process of hanging Myers out to dry. You know, whether Bush will cop to that or not, you know, the political machine surrounding Bush, I'm sure, would do this, and he seems somewhat powerless when it comes down to real well, I mean, he's a stubborn guy, as you said, but how stubborn is he really with a couple more years on his term?
Well, you know who could this... let's think about this. Howard Feynman yesterday said there are two camps in the Bush administration. There's the Card camp and the Rove camp. Rove has been out trying to sell Harriet Myers. He's the one that talked to Dobson. Where would the talk about Harriet Myers stepping down on her own come from? I speculate Andrew Card's side.
Okay, so that, all right, see that? So the game becomes broader. Now, we'll try to, you know, talk about this a little more, but we do want to talk about, speaking of Karl Rove, we want to talk about his continuing demise. There's been some new revelations, and we want to do a little refresher on what the plame case is, what the outing of the leak case is all about, what it's based on, who's really involved, who the Iraq group is, who stands to lose the biggest. We're going to do a little primer, a refresher thing on that in just a second. It's 18 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Twenty-two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Good morning to all you atoning Jews. Good morning to you Jews who are not atoning and just taking the day off. And good morning to all you non-Jews who are enjoying a day off, but maybe having a moment of atonement for whatever personal reason you have. It's just not, supported by the Bible. Today, the Old Testament is not supporting your atonement, but you're free to atone. It's on, you know, it's up to you. Right, Chris? Huh? What are you looking at me funny? Maybe you should take a few minutes and clear that moral palate in the back of your brain, my friend. How about that? How about taking a few pieces off of that?
My palate is fine.
Ah.
But I will, actually. Thank you very much for the offer.
Are you saying you got no sticky business on your palate?
None that I want to atone for.
Oh. Hold on to those sins, my friend. All right, well, here's some sins that we want to talk about for a minute, because I realized yesterday, as did we all here at the show, that, you know, we talk a lot about this plame investigation, about this, you know, revealing of the identity of a covert operative. That this happened, it's already been a couple of years almost, or over 2 years, and, you know, a lot of people may not know what the hell we're talking about. I know that if pressed, I would be, you know, it would be hard for me to tell you exactly what Watergate was about. I was too young to know, and I still barely know all the facts about Watergate, because that's just by virtue of who I am and the fact that I haven't sat down and done all the big homework. Though I know basically what it's about, but I guess what I'm saying is we just want to tell you, if you don't know, what exactly this scandal is about, because I think it's important for people to know as they watch all of the leaders of this country marched out in handcuffs of the White House and put on a parade, you know, in a courtroom that they should know what it's about. In the months leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, U.S. officials publicly presented evidence they claimed showed that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and it was actively seeking to produce chemical and nuclear weapons. A lot of this evidence was questionable, particularly documents the U.S. cited that appeared to depict Iraq's purchase of yellow cake uranium from Niger. In February 2002, retired Ambassador Joe Wilson, guest of our show several times, was sent to Niger by the CIA to investigate the yellow cake documents.
Now, let me stop you there for a second, okay? Because this is a crucial point about February 2002, and it's something that the right has spun out of control. In 2002, what Joe Wilson said was that the vice president's office had an interest in the story. He did not say that Dick Cheney sent him to Niger, which is how they've tried to spin that. They've also said that his wife was the one that sent him or had him billeted for that particular assignment. That, too, was totally untrue.
Okay. So Wilson, so who did send him?
Officials within the CIA, and she may have said, yeah, he'd be a good person to go, but it was not Valerie Plame's insistence or instigation that Joe Wilson was sent to Niger.
But it may have been by Dick Cheney's instigation to CIA officials.
Well, yeah, because Dick Cheney wanted to know about the Niger yellow cake connection.
Because he wanted to make the case. So
yes.
Wilson said it didn't take long to determine that a Niger-Iraq transaction was highly unlikely, and he reported back to the CIA that the yellow cake documents should be considered, quote, unreliable. In his 2003 State of the Union address, Bush cited the unreliable documents anyway, saying, quote, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa, end quote. In a July 6, 2003 New York Times op-ed, Wilson publicly criticized the Bush administration for using the unreliable yellow cake documents as part of their justification for the invasion. Wilson said that the administration misrepresented intelligence findings in order to bolster a pre-established agenda to invade Iraq. Now, this has been, you know, we have talked about this over and over again. It's common knowledge among most progressives, most liberals, most Democrats, and I think even some Republicans that this was all a load of crap. Now, what happens afterwards is what the case is really about. This is, you know, what happens after July 6th, after Wilson publicly criticized the Bush administration in his New York Times op-ed, is what is being investigated right now. And we're going to tell you what that is and how that unfolded and also where the investigation is at, you know, today. In just a few minutes, we're also going to have Al-Qaeda news. You know, we just got that transmission yesterday. We want to play it for you again this morning. At 27 past the hour, you're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
And Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
All right, it's 34 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Hi.
Hey, folks. Democrats are waking up to the possibility they might have a chance in the midterm election. Hello. They are looking for candidates for Congress in a race that even a few months ago they thought were races that were unwinnable. So here's what I'm saying. Here's your chance, you know-it-alls and couch pundits. Get out there and make a go of it. We need 15 seats in the House and 6 seats in the Senate. Could you take care of that? If possible, have a vision. All right, if possible. We're going to get into this a little more in a few minutes, but let's finish up with explaining to you, as many of you know, exactly what happened now after Joe Wilson posted his op-ed piece in the New York Times, July 6, 2003, publicly criticizing the Bush administration and for using the unreliable yellow cake documents as part of their justification for the invasion of Iraq. So after that, bang, this is like July 14th in a newspaper column by Robert Novak, 8 days after Wilson's New York Time column, Valerie Plame, Joe Wilson's wife, her identity as a CIA operative was exposed, along with the allegations that Plame had a role in sending Wilson to Niger to undermine the administration's Iraq claims. Okay, Plame had worked undercover for the CIA for nearly 20 years. The leaking of the identity of an undercover agent is a felony and a treasonous act. Novak wrote that two senior administration officials told him it was Plame who suggested Wilson for the trip. The CIA says its counter-proliferation officials selected Wilson and asked his wife to contact him. Now, make sure you keep in mind, Dick Cheney was at the CIA every other day trying to figure out a way to get that agency to substantiate what he wanted substantiated to get us into this war. And that's the bottom line. And now, as you'll see, and we're going to talk about this a little later, too, the CIA has been gutted. All these FEMA has been gutted to serve only one purpose, to use as political tools. They no longer have anything to do with the governing of human beings. Not that the CIA, you know, that was not their ever their primary focus, but nonetheless, now, you know, they stuck a congressman in there to run the place.
Oh, Porter Goss?
Yeah.
I don't even know if he's running the place anymore.
Hey, who knows what's going on over there? After the revelation of Plame's identity, Wilson publicly claimed that Karl Rove had leaked the identity of his wife in retaliation for his public contradiction of the Bush administration claims about the war in Iraq. In September 2003, the CIA requested that the Justice Department investigate the matter. A subsequent special investigation was launched and placed under the direction of Patrick Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald's grand jury concludes at the end of this month, October 28, 2005. And now today, in that investigation, Judith Miller appeared for a second time and testified. She filled in some blanks about a conversation with Scooter Libby, that is Dick Cheney's chief of staff. She has successfully gotten herself off the hook. Fitzgerald said she is done testifying, and the contempt of court charge that was hanging over her head is now been thrown away. Now, who is the Iraq group? Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal suggested that Fitzgerald's grand jury investigation may be focusing on the Iraq group as opposed to a specific singular leaker or two. It would imply a broader conspiracy emanating from a group of White House officials that were put together to sell the reasons and strategy of going into Iraq to the American public. Here's who they are and what they did. Now, keep in mind, or if you didn't know it in your mind, Andrew Card started the Iraq group in 2002. So let's lay some of this stuff out, Riley. Who's in this thing?
Okay. It was formed, as you mentioned, in August 2002. That timeline is important because that was after Joe Wilson had gone to Niger, okay? And it was in the run-up to the war. And there are a lot of people who believe that the administration knew even before August of 2002 that Iraq was in their crosshairs.
95 something. Was it Pax Americana in that document from the neocon manifesto?
Yeah.
Basically saying that this is our big plan, not only to have a free market haven, but to consolidate our security on an international level by having a permanent occupation of Iraq?
Yeah. Now, what we have in this group are, among others, Scooter Libby, chief of staff to Dick Cheney, vice president of the United States. It was Libby, when Cheney, I guess, was busy or on the road, who went out to the CIA and wanted to know about uranium sales to Iraq. Now, this is important because if a vice president's chief of staff shows up on your doorstep and says, you know, I need this, I need that, I need the other, the inference in you know, our bureaucracy is he's acting on behalf of his boss.
Of course.
Okay? That Cheney wanted to know these things.
Of course.
All right. Number two, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, someone who's very close to Condoleezza Rice, current Secretary of State. He got an email from Rove about his conversation with Time Magazine's Matt Cooper, warned by the CIA not to cite the uranium evidence that Joe Wilson I had obviously debunked.
This was just revealed last week, this email between Rove and Hadley.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, he is believed to have been questioned by the special prosecutor. Andrew Card, and I, you know, he seems to be one of the major players that's emerging in this drama. He got a 12-hour head start on the Justice Department investigation, courtesy of our good friend Alberto Gonzalez. He was on Air Force One with the State Department memo that described Valerie Wilson's role at the CIA. We don't know yet whether he actually looked at it. Who else was on that flight? I think Powell, who was then Secretary of State,
Bush,
and others. He's also believed to have been questioned by the special prosecutor. We, of course, know Deputy Chief of Staff and architect Karl Rove, who now we know spoke with Matt Cooper and Robert Novak about Valerie Wilson's role at the CIA.
Testified four times.
This is no longer a matter of conjecture, folks. We know on the record as fact that Rove talked to these people. Now, what they talked about seems to be at issue. Rove says welfare reform, like he calls a Time Magazine reporter to talk welfare reform every day.
Well, you know what's interesting is what you're talking about, Riley, is that, you know, Feynman from NBC.
Yeah.
who made the comment that there might be infighting within the Inner Sanctum, that, you know, Karl Rove and Andrew Card might be in some sort of fight, and it might be a rat fight.
Yeah.
Right? This might be, you know, tactics, you know, who's going to sell who out? And that's pretty interesting. We have the Feynman sound. This is from NBC. This is from Chris Matthews' show, Hardball, and his first name is Norman?
Howard
Feynman. Howard, I'm sorry. Let's listen to this real quick.
The Bush family, political family, is at war with itself inside the White House. My sense is it's Andy Card, the chief of staff, and his people against Karl Rove, the brain.
Right.
And that runs through a whole lot of things, whether it's Harriet Myers or Katrina, but it all starts with Iraq and some submerged but now emerging divisions within the administration over why we went into that war, how we went into that war, and what was done to sell it. There are people out for Karl Rove inside that White House, which makes his situation even more perilous.
That was Howard Feynman Tuesday night in MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews. This is interesting stuff because this is like the desperate throes of political survival in this White House, and it's very exciting. So who are the rest of these people? We got Karl Rove. Now we got who else?
Well, we got Condoleezza Rice, our current Secretary of State. Now, we should say about Card and Rove, it appears, at least on its face, that Rove was much more intimately involved in all this than Card was in terms of trying to put together the momentum for the ramping up to the war. And maybe that's at the root of what Feynman was talking about, that Card is now really starting to think, wait a minute, did we get sandbagged here?
Yeah.
Because remember, his first allegiance as chief of staff is to George W. Bush. Condoleezza Rice received a briefing book that may have contained that same State Department memo describing Valerie Wilson's role at the CIA. She protected Cheney on some of those Sunday talk shows back in the day by explaining he had nothing to do with sending Wilson to Niger, and dismissed the yellow cake issue. Now, what's interesting about this is Condoleezza Rice hasn't touched down on American soil, it seems, for the last month or so.
I know.
She's been traveling.
Except to buy shoes.
Yeah, to buy shoes. She's been visiting the stands this week. Kyrgyzstan, Pakistan, Afghanistan. She's been all across these regions. And apparently, if one piece in the paper is to be believed, she doesn't really want to come back. Her job, she sees as Secretary of State, is to travel, and maybe by traveling, she'll avoid all this
mess. That's right. Stay out of the way, because you know what? They're putting their hopes on her for a presidential run, or at least a vice presidential run.
Yeah, in 2008. Now, here's a very interesting person in this mix. Mm-hmm. Senior Advisor Mary Matlin, who, of course, is married to none other than James Carville. Mary Matlin is a longtime Republican functionary, longtime Republican pundit. She's been on TV for a million years. She's been working with Dick Cheney, worked with Dick Cheney back then, and she testified before the grand jury. Now, I wonder what she might have said to them.
Well, I do hold her responsible for neutering Carville. You know what I mean? Carville used
he has
to have
been kind of off the scene.
Oh, boy. You know, and then, of course, there's a communications director, Dan Bartlett. He was on the plane. And then Karen Hughes, of course, who denied Rove's involvement in the leak and helped draft that State of the Union address with the false uranium claim. So this is the Iraq group. This is what we think the grand jury, these are the people that they're focusing on. Who's more guilty? Who is going to get off? Who's going to get indicted? Those are the big questions. That was your little primer on what is going on and as far as we know. A couple weeks ago, the Washington Post reported that Al-Qaeda had begun producing Western-style newscasts for the Internet, complete with an anchor in a ski mask and a gun pointed at the camera. This is true, folks. Well, our crack investigative squad managed to get another advanced copy of the next broadcast. So here's the latest dispatch from Al-Qaeda News.
From around the world, out of an undisclosed location, and from under a hood to hide our identity, this is Al-Qaeda News.
Good evening.
And by that we mean fear us!
I am Mohammed.
And I am Mahmoud.
Tonight's top story, the female reporter from New York Times, Judith Miller, has revealed who told her name of exposed CIA agent. Skura Libby, you are Al-Qaeda feel-good story of the week.
American national security has been compromised. People should be pleased, but their brains are diseased by castrating women and gay sex. Death to America! Death to imperialism!
We have some breaking news from London. A bomb has gone off at undisclosed location at approximately 3:15. Tomorrow. Give it a take. Now in Hollywood news, here's Jerry with the Tinseltown update.
Party girl Paris Hilton has called off her engagement with fiancé Paris Latsis.
Oh boy, you're kidding. They look so happy.
The 24-year-old star of The Simple Life told reporters she just wasn't ready for marriage and didn't want to rush into it.
24? She should have 10 children by now. She's letting life pass by.
Thank you, Jerry. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, I just want to let my family know I'm alive and being treated well.
Thank you, Jerry. You will die soon. And finally, What? I can't read cue card. As producer, we cut to sports now.
Sports! Human interest!
Idiot.
Oh, yes. Now, a special feature. We close with human interest commentary from very special guests. Here are Few Minutes with Osama Bin Rooney.
You know what irritates me. American imperialism and the great citizen George Bush. But also, airport baggage claim. My bag always lasts one come out. Who gets first bag? No one! Then I have strip shirts, then gunmen appear, and I must flee and hide in cave for 4 years.
That was a Few Minutes with Osama Bin Rooney. And that is all for our kind of news. Remember, when news happens,
we caused it.
Bye-bye!
Yay, wrong comedy. Yay, right. Hey, fear equals votes, folks. Mayor Bloomberg's lead nearly doubled after last week's terror threat. We're going to have a discussion about that in just a few minutes. A little later in the show, we are going to discuss, you know, whether Democrats can pull together a vision because there's an opening here. Or are we just going to sit here? What do we need to do? What do you need to do? It's 46 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Fifty-one past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I just saw Johnny K Street come in, and he's waving his piece around and saying that he wanted to go on now. I can see him in the booth, but he's going to have to wait. You know, I hope that's not going to cause a problem. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying, as we know. And we're going to talk about Mr. Michael Bloomberg in just a second in terms of, you know, how he utilized fear in gaining support that, you know, he already had, but now it's ridiculous. Luckily, we have this iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator, so why don't we crank this thing up and feed it some headlines? What do you say to that? Man, Brendan could come back and not even recognize this show. From the Associated Press, Gonzalez urges, give Myers a chance. Gonzalez urges, give Myers a chance. Translation, now Alberto Gonzalez wants to torture everybody. Oh, from CNN, Senator McCain campaigns for Schwarzenegger initiatives. Senator McCain campaigns for Schwarzenegger initiatives. Translation, fake action hero gets boost from real action hero. All right. From ABC News, Chinese crew blasts off for space mission. Chinese crew blasts off for space mission. Translation, Chinese seek creative solutions to overpopulation. There you go. How do you like that, my friends? Atoning. Mayor Bloomberg's lead nearly doubled after last week's terror threat, and he put the city on high alert. Bloomberg is now leading Ferrer by, what, 28 points, Riley?
28 points in one poll, 27 points in another.
The Quinnipiac poll began questioning voters 2 days earlier. At that point, Bloomberg was only about 19 points ahead after the news conference.
Only.
After the news conference Thursday, where he announced raising the alert, he bounced up 34 points. The real question is here, Riley, did he know beforehand? Was this a political move? Were there discussions pro and con about the impacts of a terror alert on the campaign? I would have to say yes to at least all of those. I am not willing to completely sign off on the fact that Bloomberg said, here's our opportunity, let's do a terror alert. But somebody must have sat him down and said, look, you know, it's been guaranteed in the past. Creating fear of disaster equals votes and control, my friend. I think the gamble is good. Do it.
Well, I don't know if they were thinking about it being a gamble at that point. I think, one, Mike Bloomberg is a delegator of authority, which means his first decision on whether or not to issue a terror alert would be based on information supplied to him by the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, who is not, and I repeat, not a partisan. He served a Democrat mayor and a Republican mayor.
Right.
So Ray Kelly's information is going to come through relatively unfiltered. Now, yeah, there are people in the campaign that might have weighed the pros and cons of going at that particular time with a terror alert. what the impact might be if something happened, if there was, but that could be considered advanced planning. I don't think they said, well, we're going to time this so that, A, it undercuts the flack he was getting for not debating at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, which he was under heavy attack for because that was the day of the debate. And I don't think that he sat up and decided, well, my poll numbers are going to have a huge spike here, so I think I'll do it now. That's not how he operates.
Okay, that's from your personal knowledge, and you're watching Michael Bloomberg over the years, and you know, but also that came right on the heels of George Bush's speech trying to refrighten America into believing in his failed effort in Iraq, and the continuing devastation and loss of troops there. You know, the timing is very suspect. And you know, the bottom line is that I, as a reasonably progressive person, as a liberal person, I got to be honest with you. I'm afraid too, because the bottom line is, you know, whether you're progressive, liberal, or Democrat, there is all evidence that shows that there are people in this world that will blow themselves up on trains. They've done it. There are people that get on planes and fly them into buildings. They've done it, okay? Who those people are and, you know, what they're, you know, I'm not even discussing that. But the bottom line is that is a truism in the world we live in. So I know that when I see cops or when I hear a terror threat, my first reaction is not always, this is a scam. I mean, during the elections, I saw them use it for political purposes, and I don't know if that's the same as crying wolf. It seems manipulative. But even if it is crying wolf on some degree, when I see cops go into the street because something might blow up that I'm on, you know, there's part of me that goes, well, that's good that we know how to do this. I don't know if it'll stop anything, and I don't know what the real answers are. I mean, the answers on that level are, you know, a more effective law enforcement, more effective information. But we've been shown that even that might not necessarily stop this from happening. There is an inevitability that it will happen. And I don't personally subscribe to the fact that, you know, all of Al-Qaeda is somehow or another a covert CIA plot or, you know, or something on behalf of English intelligence. You know, I'm not going to go that far off the margin. But it is clear that these organizations, that, you know, the Homeland Security Department, that, you know, certain factions of the FBI and the CIA, you know, have been used for political gain and are not effective in actually acquiring and finding information that is valid.
Well, I mean, at this point, the New York people had, from what they felt was evidence of a credible threat. They had to act on that evidence. Now, the poll numbers that are coming out now about Mike Bloomberg versus Freddie Ferrer, I think almost transcend this entire terror threat issue, because he's leading now, according to the latest Quinnipiac poll, 53-38% among likely black voters. That's incredible for a Republican in this day and time. He's leading 45-43 in the Bronx, Fernando Ferrer's home base.
Yeah, so you're saying that even without the terror threat, it was unnecessary.
Yeah.
So to analyze it and deconstruct it in that way is not really true. But, you know, there is no doubt that it was a flexing of muscle.
Yeah.
You know, whether he was honestly scared or he wasn't scared to ride the subway once the police were there, but whether he did it for political reasons specifically, you say no, I say probably not, but there was definitely discussion. 57 past the hour, Morning Sedition, Johnny K. Street coming up next. All right, it's 6 past the hour. It's Thursday. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Mark Riley should be there. Are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, there he is. How do you like that? How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens? I hope everything's okay, lurking conservatives, and of course, you progressives who believe that civil rights is really just how you treat your nanny. How are you guys? Because God knows you're important and your money is important. And that's what really drives so much of getting the message out, isn't it? Look, we'll be broadcasting live from Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District tomorrow morning. We'll have New York City Democratic mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer plus Lawton Smalls, MILF Cardinal Milvington. So come on down. You want to talk to Ferrer, because Ferrer's He's in a tight spot. Not even a tight spot. I mean, I am curious to hear how he's going to sort of respond to this incredible inflation in the polls of Michael Bloomberg, post-terror alert. I'm excited to talk to Freddie to see what's going on. You, Riley?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, it's all right. So for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Architects and planners from all over the country are meeting to discuss how to rebuild the Gulf Coast. Some are resisting new urbanism, saying, how could we deny our children the architecture we grew up with? The red roof of Pizza Hut, the nautical motif of Long John Silver's, the sweeping parking lot at Walmart. Some southern traditions are sacred. Historians say the region may be slow to rebuild, pointing out that Mississippi always opposed Reconstruction. Yahoo is shutting down internet chat rooms. Yahoo is shutting down internet chat rooms that promote sex between adults and children. Somehow Yahoo got the idea that chat rooms with labels such as kiddies who love sex, girls 13 and up for much older men, and teen girls for older fat men might not be entirely on the up and up. Many of these chat rooms were located under the chat category schools and education, possibly left over from the old Catholic schools news group. Some of the chat rooms had names like kiddies who like sex, teens for older fat men, and the oddly named undercover FBI agents who crave pedophile action. Man, that's a stunted punchline. Boy, I stunted that punch. What are you going to say, K.O.? You got something to say? You putting your hands on a button? What's on your mind?
I still think it worked. It was great.
Oh, how do you like that? Oh, look at that. That's my heart filled with warmth. That's the end of the music because I got another joke.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Could you bring it back up again? All right. Raj Bhakta, a former contestant on The Apprentice, says he may run for Congress. He was the ninth apprentice fired by Donald Trump that season. On his way out the door, he hit on Trump's receptionist. This alone qualifies him for a job in Congress. Bhakta has no legal training or political experience whatsoever, leading many to think he should forego running for Congress and just wait to be appointed to the Supreme Court. Okay, you can shut it down. Abruptly shut it down. Great.
That's there nice. You go.
I like that. Hey, folks, Democrats, this is a message to you liberals and progressives and people that have the time to actually take action on the ground will make the time. Democrats are waking up to the possibility that they might have a chance in the midterm elections. This is obviously true. They are looking for candidates for Congress in races that even a few months ago they thought were unwinnable. Folks, here's your chance. Come on, I'm reaching out to you know-it-alls and you couch pundits. Get out there and make a go of it. We need 15 seats in the House and 6 seats in the Senate. If possible, if you could, have a vision. That's a big question. Where's the vision? Where's the spine? All right. Anyone who has momentum or charisma is going to come under severe attack from the gargantuan right-wing slander machine. That's a given. The problem is, that Democrats are seemingly incapable themselves of fully getting behind a candidate. We eat our own over petty issues. And now there's a lot of Democrats standing on the sidelines waiting for this GOP to eat itself. They have plenty of opportunities. I think there are plenty of things to run on. I mean, Riley, you could run on bringing the troops home. You could run on corruption and cronyism in this administration. You could be pointing out that Bush has bankrupted the country. You could point out that the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, the FBI have all been turned out for political purposes as opposed to legitimate security. You could point out that fascist strains of Christianity and the abuse of faith-based initiative money is on its way to becoming to trying to overtake the government. There's still poverty. There are racial divides. Or you could revise the new bankruptcy legislation so people can get back on their feet again, energy independence, protecting Social Security, environmentalism. I mean, it seems like there is a million ways for someone with some charisma and some stones to get up and do something here.
Well, here's where the Democrats traditionally fall short. Let's go back to 1993, a mere 12 years ago. Republicans decided that they wanted to retake the Congress of the United States. And what they did was have a core group of conservatives, many of whom are very prominent now, 12 years later, who ran and won in 1994. That was a pivotal year. That was also the year of the contract with America, where the Republicans and conservatives put down exactly where they were coming from. Now, inarguably, they did not succeed. But what Democrats need to do is say, okay, this is where we are. This is our core value system. This is how we plan to remake government, to eliminate the cronyism, to eliminate the corruption, to have a health care program that works for most Americans. You know, to begin to deal and address some of the gut bucket issues that have really been ignored as people chase a repeal of the estate tax, as people, ruin people's ability to declare bankruptcy, those kinds of things, which are already going into effect as a result of this Congress. You've got to have a core group of people who, if they win, can act as a body to change the way Washington does its business.
Well, yeah, I think that starts with saying that you're going to do it, and that starts with saying it with some conviction and saying it with a charisma that will get you into office. I mean, certainly that's what we want. I would love for somebody to do that, but, you know, at the beginning, you've got to convince people that you will do it, and that's enough to get into office. So I want those people to start standing up and bringing some ideas to the table, right?
Well, yeah, no, they have to start bringing ideas to the table. First of all, most basically, they have to see this as an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't do you any good to talk about, you know, the mistakes the Republicans make unless you are prepared to capitalize on them.
And also, take a lesson from the Republican notebook on some level here. You know, as Michael Tomasky points out in a pretty brilliant column that that came out in the last couple of days, that, you know, the question is like, he is actually saying that some of these conservatives who are turning on the president's nomination of Harriet Myers and turning on the president's bankrupting of this country and the national debt, you know, old school fiscal conservatives, old school intellectual conservatives who are turning on the irresponsibility and incompetence of this administration should be heralded on some level, because he cites in his piece a history of Republicans, you know, getting devoutly and loyally behind their candidate despite their flaws. So for any of these guys to start jumping ship is a monumental event in terms of how Republicans deal with their, you know, relationship with their candidates and with their presidents. On the other hand, Democrats have a long history of a questionable loyalty, of not being able to stay behind candidates. Even in the election process, we saw it this time. You know, progressives, liberals, I see it all the time. I see it in your emails. I see it in the way that we handle things, that we have a certain amount of self-defeat, that we have a certain amount of know-it-allness, that we have a certain amount of criticism that disables ourselves from the inside, that no one is ever good enough. Everyone's a little dirty. You know, what you're talking about is reworking Washington from the ground up and getting rid of some of these insiders that are Democrats and also have no spine. That's going to take some time. But at the current moment in history, just to get behind some people and say, look, whatever it takes to start facilitating some of that change you're talking about, Riley, let's find these charismatic people. Let's find these people that have the conviction and the belief in their hearts that they can facilitate some change in a real way and get behind them. I mean, the problem is you look at Howard Dean. The Democrats ate their own with that one, and
well,
they continue to.
They do, because many of them in Congress are scared to death of where they think Howard Dean is taking the party. But what is important here is that people wake up to the notion that you have to have an infrastructure. You have to have consultants. You have to have fundraisers. You have to have the people on the ground, aside from the candidate, who are going to make those candidacies viable. It does Democrats no good to put a person with a great vision forward if the state party or the local party doesn't give them a dime to run on.
A dime or just a support? I don't understand it. You know, I understand on some level Democrats, progressive liberals, there is a bigger tent. We embrace diversity. We embrace all different points of view. We think about things. We debate things. But at some point, you know, as many people made a concession with John Kerry in terms of getting behind him when they didn't believe that he could be president, or they didn't really believe that, you know, he had the goods, or that what he stood for was what they wanted, or that he was the right guy. You know, we will talk about our apprehensions. You know, there's certain things, you know, I'm no good at either. I wear my heart on my sleeve. You know, I got a big mouth, and, you know, I want to say, even when I'm scared or paranoid or critical of somebody I know or somebody I believe in, I will say it, as opposed to just shut up and save it until another time, or keep it to yourself or people you trust.
Well, I'll tell you what, the Democrats could make a really good start by saying the following. A, we will not spend $24 billion in highway built pork. We will vote against any pork in any bill that comes before our desks while in Congress. The other thing they can say, and this is something that the American people have been completely bamboozled on, They can say, from now on, we will lump the expenditures for Iraq into the overall federal budget so people really know what kind of economic trouble we're in this country and how the war in Iraq is dragging our economy down.
Riley in 2008.
We'll be back
with Johnny K Street, 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Mornings Edition.
Mornings Edition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Mornings Edition. We got the Mornings Edition Radio Theater coming up, and tomorrow, Florent, all right, New York's Meatpacking District, Gansfort Street, Ready for Air, me, Mark Lawton.
Yep.
There are a lot of big stories in the news this week, so let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny K Street. Johnny, where's the action, bro?
Oh, it's me, baby.
All right.
You know, Mark, all you hear about lately is Harriet Myers. Harriet Myers, Harriet Myers. Why did Bush pick Harriet Myers of all people for the Supreme Court? I haven't seen America pay this much attention to an old woman since Maud was in prime time. Everyone wants to know what Harriet Myers believes in. I don't know. Polygrip, the home shopping channel, the first alert warning system, stewed fruit, the clapper. When this broad went to law school, they had one book in the library and one law in the books. Don't do that. It covered everything. People say she's an expert on constitutional law. That's because she knew half the guys who wrote it.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Let me clear up the whole Harriet Myers thing for you once and for all, right? Harriet Myers actually called George Bush cool. That can only mean one thing. She's suffering from dementia.
Oh, man.
You want to know what Harriet Myers is like? Put two and two together. She's been friends with Bush for years. She's been a lawyer for corporations, and she's born again. Hey, I'm not Columbo, but my guess is she might be a little on the conservative side.
Really? You think so, Johnny?
She's not Jane Fonda, let's put it that way. Even money, when she gets on that court, she turns out to be just right of Strom Thurmond.
All right, I'll take that for a grand, Johnny.
Yeah, Johnny, put me down for five.
All right. All right, what other actions are we looking at here, Johnny?
Call row, baby.
Oh, yeah.
First drove out Valerie Plame. Now he's being accused of giving James Dobson inside information on Harriet Myers. This guy leaks more than a levee in New Orleans.
Oh.
My grandfather, Angelo DiStridio, doesn't leak as much as Rove. And he's 87 with an enlarged prostate.
Did you say DiStridio?
That's the Italian pronunciation. He's from the old country.
Right.
Carl Rove keeps secrets like Henry Hill.
No.
The only time he doesn't reveal confidential information is when he's on the stand. You put a phone in his hand, he'd give up his mother. You won't hear that much squealing in a slaughterhouse, let alone the White House.
Hey, Johnny, do you think Patrick Fitzgerald is going to indict Rove?
I don't really think it. I'll give you 50 to 1 on it.
It sounds like easy money. I'll take a C-note.
All right, Rove gets indicted. I make some money. What's the downside? Give me five down. Give me five dimes worth, buddy.
Beautiful. You're covered.
Right.
You know, this whole Rove thing makes me sick.
Uh-huh.
They don't make politicians like they used to. Take a look at Kennedy. Now, there's a guy who can keep a secret.
Now, I know you have some connections to the Kennedys, right, Johnny?
My Uncle Sally Side Street was good friends with Kennedy, and my cousin Doreen and Kennedy were close, enough said.
Yeah.
Let's just say he asked her what she could do for her country, and she showed him.
Oh.
That was a president.
Johnny, all right, buddy, what kind of delay action do you have today?
Delay is telling anyone who will listen that he's innocent. He's even having his lawyer subpoena the prosecutor, Ronnie Earl. Let me tell you something. If Delay is innocent, I'll fix OJ up with my sister. If I were Tom DeLay, I would get Jack Abramoff to pay for one more trip for me to Mexico. One way!
Oh, there you go.
DeLay is going down, baby, and I'll give you 500 to 1 on it.
Hey, Whoa. Put me down for a C-note.
500 to 1, that sounds good. C-note for me, too.
You're covered. Let me just enter your bet here.
Johnny, what's that you're holding there? Is that a BlackBerry?
Yes, it is. I'm going high-tech. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking of starting my own website, CyberK Online Gaming, baby. I'm looking for sponsors, so if there's any big corporations out there that want to back me, I'm open for suggestions.
So, Johnny, you don't have any problems taking money from big corporations?
Hey, why should Bush get it all? I'm out of here. I got to go to court.
All right, Johnny, good seeing you. Take care. Good
Thanks,
luck
Johnny.
In court. Yeah, right there. Good. All right. You look at all the bling on him. He's got the whole thing going, the sweatsuit. All right, man. Good seeing you. All right, so let's move into let's talk. I guess we could talk a little bit more about the Democrat issue that I was talking about before. Is that how do we focus our energies? How do Democrats and liberals and progressives all get on the same page? And I think it starts with, you know, as I've seen over the last couple of years, a lot of people are out there taking action. A lot of people are facilitating taking action on the internet. But now we need some candidates. And this is one of those weird things that if you're sitting on your couch and you're wondering, like, I don't know if I could, you know, it seems like then I have to go and fill out papers. And, you know, if you've got the passion and you've got the belief and you've got, you know, some values you want to run on that are the values of your party, the Democratic Party in this case, why not do this? I mean, the Congress is where people start, and you don't have to be anything to get into Congress. You could be a car dealer, an insurance salesman, an internet entrepreneur.
A bug killer.
I mean, this is where it starts, and I just hope that there are some people that are putting it together, because there's a lot of smart people out there. I see their emails. I see what's going on in the blogosphere. I just hope that somebody, some young people, get involved with this and take these bastards on.
Well, I'll tell you what. Young people probably have the most to lose from the Bush policies, but they don't participate in the electoral process to the extent that their numbers suggest they could. And people, let me say something to just buttress what Mark just said. The people that are running the government in Washington, in case you haven't noticed, are not rocket scientists. These are not people who are some great geniuses. These are not people who've got all that much more on the cap than you do.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's scary, though, once you realize, you know, the way politics works, which I think a lot of people do. It's a dirty game. It's a dirty game no matter where you are, whether you're in an office or a radio network or the actual political sphere of Washington or the state legislature, you know, personal politics, business politics, actual politics. It's a weird game, and it's rough, and it's heartbreaking, and it's, you know, potentially corrupting. But you know what? It's this system is based on it. So you got to get in there and get some votes and do the right thing
and play to win.
There you go. That's it. Play to win. I forgot that one. Coming up, we've got Micah Green and Michael Guerin and Mary Helene Carlton. He was the American journalist kidnapped in Iraq last year while in the country with his girlfriend, working on a documentary about archaeological sites. We've also got radio theater coming up, 27 past, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater. This week on Morning Sedition Radio Theater, PBS's American Masters series presents a Martin Scorsese film, Mark Maron, Can I Get a Ride Home?
So everyone always asked me, you know, what the jokes meant, man. You know, especially the audience was always asking me. But hey, they're just jokes. I wrote the jokes to perform them. I never thought about what they meant. You know, Woody Guthrie was one of my biggest influences, and I used to visit him at the hospital and talk to him when he was, you know, he was dying. You know, I used to talk to him about comedy and stuff. And then I started to realize this guy isn't really very funny. So I went to a different nursing home, and I started visiting Larry Fine from the Three Stooges. I remember when I switched to an electric microphone at the Newport Folk Festival. I was right in the middle of my airline material when they started booing. And I mean, booing.
Judas!
They just didn't want to hear my jokes. You know, they wanted to hear music. I guess I should have known. It was right there on the title, you know, Folk Music Festival. Guess I screwed up.
He came out of New Jersey with just a guitar on his back. And then he got rid of the guitar and started telling jokes and getting booed. It's Martin Scorsese's Mark Maron, Can I Get a Ride Home on PBS's American Masters.
35 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. People, come down to Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District tomorrow. We're going to have Freddie Ferrer there. Lawton Smalls will be there. My buddy Russ Meneve's there tomorrow, too, right? Russ Meneve, very funny man. Tom Beller, the writer, will be there. And if you come early, like around 6:15, Freddie, we're going to ask him some questions like, what are you going to do now, man?
Oh,
all right. I'm serious.
It's only two bad polls.
I know, but they're really bad. So that's Restaurant Florent at Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District. That's tomorrow. You can touch Pops Riley. That's
no,
I
know you.
Yes, for 10 days last August, my friends, the country followed the story of an American journalist kidnapped in Iraq where he was making a documentary film about the looting of archaeological sites. Unlike many of those taken hostage in Iraq, he survived. Now, he and his fiancée have co-written a book telling the story of their ordeal called American Hostage, which comes out this week. With us here now are Mika Guerin and Marie Helen Carlton. I did it. Welcome to Morning Sedition.
Good morning.
There's a lot of names here.
Thanks for coming in.
I thought I was going to screw up one of them. So,
we did. It's Mika.
It's Mika.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Micah, you know, and like, how many times did I do that this morning? Micah. I'm sorry. It's only your name that you
have. No problem. It's on the book.
I get it all the time. Marin, moron, you know, marinated. I get a lot of ones. But let's talk to you about what's important here, which is your book. So this was not your first trip to Iraq, the one that you got kidnapped on. You've been there several times. What were you doing there this time?
Well, I was there for 5 months filming a documentary with Marie Helen, and we were filming it about the looting of archaeological sites in the South, which is pretty horrific. So we were there. This is my last week in the filming, and, you know, as happens.
Are you an archaeologist?
I studied archaeology for a number of years. I studied Sumerian and Akkadian, and so it's something that I have a good history in, but I haven't. I never practiced it.
So now, how did the events that led to your hostage taking, that you were being kidnapped, what exactly happened? What give us a paint a picture for us?
Well, I was filming my last weekend, and it was in Nasiriyah, which is one of the southern cities, which is a lot better in many ways than Baghdad, and so we never expected this kind of thing really. And I was filming in a market, and the way you have to go out to be safe, kind of the only real protection you have is to look like a local. So I had a big bushy mustache, and I wore local clothing.
Wait, you didn't paste the mustache on?
It
took a couple months of hard work.
Because that's a telltale sign that you might not be a local. Pasted mustache on. But go ahead. Sorry.
No, it was real. But they one of the people we were filming got really agitated, and I ended up, speaking, and I know a little bit of Arabic, but I ended up speaking in Egyptian Arabic, and they realized that I was a foreigner, and it just went downhill.
So you panicked and started speaking Egyptian? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, that's the only Arabic I knew was Egyptian colloquial, and I didn't think the words, the accent, they could tell, but, you know, they did.
Now, you weren't there when he got kidnapped. You had just, you'd split.
It's all about timing, and I'd been with Mika for 4 months in Iraq, and I just returned to the States. I'd been home for 2 days, and I was going to start editing the film the next day, and I was waiting for Micah's arrival. I hadn't gotten an email from him in a few days, which was strange, and I thought, well, maybe he's going to surprise me tomorrow. And instead, I got an early morning phone call saying he'd been kidnapped.
Oh, my God. That must have been horrendous.
It was the most frightening thing.
I could imagine, yeah.
And you can either be paralyzed by fear, or you have to do something. And I was very lucky that I'd been to Iraq, because my reaction was just to jump on the phone and start calling people. And we're very lucky because everyone reacted that way.
Like, who do you call? News. Who do you call when someone gets kidnapped in Iraq?
Anyone you can think of.
But
we had we knew a lot of journalists on the ground, and they're the ones who have relationships with people who can get you information, who can pass appeals, and we called people, journalists in Baghdad, in Erbil, in the south, and they called us, and Micah's sister got on the phone. Everyone
good friend. We were actually very fortunate in a lot of ways, because some of our friends were very well connected, and one of them had worked filming the Sadr office down in Nasiriyah. And so he was up in Erbil, but he immediately got on the phone and started calling his contacts.
Muqtada al-Sadr's office?
Yeah. And he was saying, you know, please, please release him. So he was, Muqtada al-Sadr was the militant leader whom the people who kidnapped me looked up to.
The Shiite.
The Shiite militant leader.
Now, did you know, we've talked to some journalists who've been on the ground in Iraq, and they have told us in the past that sometimes kidnappings are simply nothing more than criminal acts, not necessarily political acts. When did you know that your kidnapping was, in fact, political?
Well, it started, I think, as some mix of the two, in it, because when they saw that I was a foreigner and that, you know, I had a camera, I think they thought that I might have been a spy.
A spy, yeah.
So they immediately, you know, it wasn't immediately criminal, but then, in that country where people live on $500 a year, you know, money, of course, is a huge thing. So, particularly if you're a criminal gang, any way you can make money. So, I think it was always a mix. And sometimes they would ask for money from me. Sometimes it would be, you know, clearly political. But I think, you know, once I was actually held captive, I think it became very political quickly.
So part of the negotiation to get you freed, outside of calling journalists and you get this guy in Muqtada al-Sadr's office, was al-Sadr actually became involved in it? I can't even imagine the fear and chaos involved in being held hostage in the company of what was the most radical cleric of the Shia religion there at that time. What was that like? Did you meet the guy?
There was a intense fighting going on in Najaf at the time. It was probably the worst time to be kidnapped because that was when the coalition was trying to end the Sadr uprising. So they were launching a massive attack against Sadr's group in Najaf, and that's where Sadr was. I was down in Nasiriyah a few hours south of there, and they had driven me out to the marshes, and this group was...
Oh, that's never good, the drive to the marshes. Oh, no. Oh my God!
Yeah, I was actually blindfolded and bound, and
I'm getting uncomfortable.
Yeah, it was really horrific. You kind of laugh about it now, but it was just absolutely terrifying. But he did get involved, Muqtada al-Sadr, but only after a number of appeals were made, and the group, as best as we can tell, they weren't directly part of his group, but they were followers. It's kind of a decentralized thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you get, during the time that you were kidnapped, did you get a tangible sense that people, was there a great deal of anti-Americanism? You mentioned that there was all this fighting with the coalition troops, which most, I guess, Iraqis see as Americans, and they were trying to wipe out al-Sadr's uprising. Did you get a sense that people had a particular thing with you because they realized you were American?
Absolutely. They really considered at that point most foreigners, but particularly America, was the enemy. So it didn't help my case at all. And I was hoping, Marie-Hélène is half French, so we used to travel under her passport, and I used to just never say anything. You know, I just was, the person with. Person with a French passport.
So now, after you made all the calls to try to facilitate, his release and figure out what was going on with him, did you travel to Iraq? What were the steps that you took to sort of make this happen?
We contemplated going to Iraq, but we thought that it would be, and we thought we would have gone there if that's what we had to do. And all our family showed up with passports. Everyone was ready to go.
Yeah.
But it was much better to be working from the U.S. where we had phones that could be working 24 hours a day. So it turned into a war. Our small studio apartment in the West Village turned into a war room where 24 hours a day people were on the phone working with a committee to protect journalists who sent a family representative down to Nasiriyah. So there was a lot of work done to get information about Micah. The first few days we had no idea who had taken him. And it wasn't until the video came out that we had we saw him for the first time.
Did you have to see that on TV with everybody else the first time? Or
that's how we found out. Yeah.
Oh,
because
my
until
God.
Then, we had heard from our friend James Longley, who was calling the Sadr office in Nasiriyah. We were hearing Mike and Amir are fine, they're alive, things are looking hopeful for their release, and then the video came.
Oh, God.
And that was a shattering experience because we'd been working on the assumption that it was a Shiite group. But when the video came out, a video isn't really a Shiite tool.
Yeah.
It's not something that they've used before, and we thought, maybe he's been sold, or maybe somehow the Shiite group is a radical offshoot.
And he could have been dead already. Did you think that?
No, I didn't feel that he was dead. And the information that we were getting was that both of them were fine and were alive. And
okay.
We could work on this. And then the video came, and that was a really...
How long between the release of the video how long between that and his release?
The video came on Wednesday. It was made actually on Tuesday, but it wasn't broadcast till Wednesday, and then Micah was released on Sunday.
Okay, so that was...
What was that like? I mean, when did you get the sense that they were not going to do anything to you, that they're actually going to let you go?
Well, when I first got in, so this is Friday afternoon that they took us out into the marshes, and, you know, they brought us into a small enclosure, and for the first few days, we were really hoping that this would be settled quickly, because we thought, you know, once they realized that we're journalists, you know, they shouldn't really turn this into, you know, something else. And of course, we didn't really know who was holding us, but as the days dragged on, you know, it just started looking worse and worse. And then 5 days into it, without warning, they came and blindfolded me, tied me up, separated me from my translator, who was with me the whole time.
Amir.
And then took me into a building for the first time. And that's when they made the video. And that was probably the lowest moment, because, you know, up till then, you think, you know, well, nothing's happening, so that's probably a good sign. But as soon as they did that, we'd seen those videos before.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm glad you're alive, and I guess out of all this, you two ended up getting engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? To be married? You weren't before.
No. It was an unexpected but very good thing.
second day was my decision in the enclosure.
See that? He had a little time for reflection with the blindfold on. Our guests have been Micah Guerin and Marie Helen Carlton.
Perfect.
Okay, good. The book is American Hostage, a memoir of a journalist kidnapped in Iraq and the remarkable battle to win his release. I'm glad you're alive, and congratulations on your engagement. Good luck with the book.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's 47 past the hour. We'll have Future Mark in a minute, so hang out. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
All right, 52 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. What is that called again? Hey, tomorrow we'll be broadcasting from Restaurant Florent in New York's Meatpacking District. Come down. Freddie Ferrer is going to be there early. If you want to hear Freddie or ask him a question about his campaign and what he's got planned for New York City, come down early, like at 6. We got Lawton Smalls also, Milf Cardinal Milfington, my buddy Russ Maneev, very funny comic. Tom Beller is going to be there from Mr. Beller's Neighborhood. He's an author and raconteur of a literary raconteur, I will call him that.
Hey, Mark.
Yeah.
Future Mark is online one.
Cool. I love that guy. Put him on.
Hey buddy. What's up?
So, Future Mark, what's going on in 2050?
I'm eating, man. Dinner number 3. Got to keep my weight up.
Keep your weight up? Oh, no. Am I fat in the future?
Oh, you betcha. 300 pounds of heavenly joy right here, buddy.
300 pounds? What happened? Did I just let myself go or what?
No. There was a biochemical disaster in 2021 and most of Kazakhstan just fell off, dude. It ruined the alignment of the earth and now the gravity fluctuates day to day, kind of like the weather. Mm. So everyone has to stay really fat just to keep our balance.
Wow.
Hold on. Lasagna guy's here. Oh, yeah. Come to Papa. Whew. I'm exhausted.
So... what happens if you're thin?
Well, you just float away. Happens all the time. That's how we lost future Brendan McDonald. He's still orbiting, dude. Oh. The poor skinny bastard. Sometimes on a clear night, you can see him past the moon. There goes another one. There are public service announcements all the time. Eat more. But do they listen?
Hey, is that an ambulance?
No, it's Domino's truck.
Really?
They're considered emergency vehicles now.
Huh.
That meat lover's combo could be saving somebody's life, Mark.
Hey, dude, isn't it dangerous to eat so much?
Not when it's chocolate broccoli. It's this good. Oh, man.
Oh, man. They put chocolate on broccoli?
No. It's just chocolate shaped like broccoli. Whoa, sorry, dude. Too many hot Velveeta shots last night. On the plus side, I am huge today. Screw you, light gravity.
Hey, that's disgusting.
Not anymore, my friend. It's energy. That's right. Our super high-fat diet has us producing so much methane that we use it for all our energy needs. No more OPEC holding us hostage, pal. We get all the energy we need about 2 hours after eating a chili cheeseburger. Oh, wow. That's the sound of energy independence, my buddy. Let freedom ring. You want to hear the national anthem?
Do I have to?
Just the end. Kind of chokes you up just a little, doesn't it?
Okay, dude, whatever. You got any advice for me in the future?
Eat early, eat often, and keep some mayonnaise in the car for emergency. Gotta go. Time for dessert. There's always room for chicken fried cheesecake with gravy. Later, skinny.
Later, man. Oh, how depressing is that? And exciting in a weird way that perhaps in the future, if I catch up with future Mark, I get to eat like that. Man, I envy these thin guys that can just eat and eat and eat and never put on any weight. That would be the greatest thing ever, Riley. Can you imagine that?
Huh?
Mr. Eating the pastries early in the morning?
Well, just a couple.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody brought munchkins in.
Riley acts like he doesn't eat, and now I've seen his pattern. He'll go to the machine and sneak something.
No, I don't sneak. Sneak means I go in the bathroom or something. You don't sneak. No, but you know, by the way, what? Today is our man Chip's birthday.
Oh,
you know,
Chip the engineer. Our engineer is how old?
Your age.
Oh, happy birthday, Chip.
42.
42. I wish we would have gotten him a cake or something, but I didn't think to get him a cake. You know why?
Somebody got him a munchkins.
What?
I didn't know it was his birthday.
Somebody should put out an email. If this was an organized network corporation type of situation, there'd be emails that went out that alerted people to things.
We should hire someone to just keep track of birthdays.
We can't afford that.
Vice president kidding? In charge of birthdays?
All right, look, we got in a minute we're going to have, what are we going to have?
Congresswoman Maxine Waters.
There you go. Yeah. And we're going to have
Sammy the Stem Cell.
Oh, Sammy the Stem Cell.
In that order?
Everybody's favorite comedic stem cell character. I tell you,
from all the comedic stem cells out there.
Oh, that bit gets so much attention. You know, what's great about our show is that we're not afraid to offend. And I think that's important. You know why? Because I think that offense makes people think, and I think it gets people angry, and it gets them worked up, and it makes them see just how ridiculous they are for being offended at a joke. Yeah, look at that.
Yeah, I'm not offended by this.
Riley's got a picture of Jim Earl when he was how old?
I don't know. This was back in the 80s, and 82.
You're excited about it? It's weird. It's a painting.
It's a painting.
And Riley's brought though. This relationship between you two has gotten peculiar.
Yeah.
All right. It's 57 past the hour. Maxine Waters and Sammy the Stem Cell soon. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Blah, blah, blah.
All right, it's 6 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hallelujah. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
It's nice to see you. Nice to see everybody in the booth. Today is Thursday. We're doing okay.
Yeah.
I hope everyone out there is okay. You know, I just want to reach out a little bit and tell you, if you live in the New York area, my friends, you have a tremendous opportunity to come see Mark Riley and I perform our show live at Florent, Restaurant Florent. We're going back there. It's in New York's meatpacking district. We're going to have Freddie Ferrer, the mayoral candidate, who is going to tell us how he's going to beat Michael Bloomberg.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be some interesting stuff. He's on early, so if you want to hear Freddie, you want to ask Freddie a question or two, you got to come down around 6. We'll have Lawton Smalls. We'll have Milf Cardinal Milfington. We're going to have my buddy Russ Meneves going to do a few jokes. We're going to have Tom Beller, the author, a literary raconteur of sorts. He's going to be down there. I like him. He's a friend of mine. A little later in the show, we're going to have Sammy the Stem Cell on, and also a little later in the show, we are going to talk about the Democratic possibilities for 2006.
Sammy the Stem Cell?
Yes, Sammy the Stem Cell.
Our audience favorite?
Oh boy, you know, lately, you know, the audience has sort of been like, you know, they've been a little, the comedy has riled some people. But you know, I enjoy that. I think that's important that comedy riles people. You can't all be, you know, snarky and cute and touching. You know what I mean? It's got to boom, pow. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Bang, bing.
Can't all be Dean Martin.
That's right. Well, I'd wish everybody could be Dean Martin. The idea of everybody being Dean Martin would just be wonderful. Is, Okay, here we go. Is pressure mounting on Harriet Myers to withdraw her nomination for the Supreme Court? Is it possible that Dick Cheney could be involved in the Plame affair? How much trouble is Bill Frist in, really? Joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. to give us her take on these and other stories is Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters from California's 35th District. Good morning, Congresswoman.
Good morning, Mark and Mark. How are you doing?
All right. How you doing, Congresswoman?
Good, good, good.
Thanks
What's
so much.
What's going on this morning?
Well, I'll tell you, we got some questions for you. It seems like the Republicans are starting to come apart at the seams. They can't seem to be on the same page, and that's very exciting. Is it? What do you see down there? Is it stone?
Well, it's extremely exciting. You know, the president got too cute with coming up with this nominee for the Supreme Court, and it appears that even Republicans disagree with him about taking his own personal lawyer, and then he can't tell us what our qualifications are. Now, I guess the big new qualification is her religion.
Yeah, that's all she's got, apparently.
Well, I tell you, I don't think we're looking for the Taliban, or we're looking for a government that is headed by religious, born-again Christians.
Now, Congresswoman, the First Lady, Laura Bush, says that some of the criticism of Harriet Myers is sexist. Do you agree?
Well, it's very interesting that she's playing that card. Whenever we try and talk with this administration about sexism and racism, they accuse us of playing the sexism card or the racism card. Now they want to pull it out and use it. I don't think it's going to fly. It doesn't work. And to tell you the truth, even though, you know, she has a pretty good reputation, she's not been way out there for women. She's not really done a lot of promoting of women, so it's very interesting that she would pull that out at this time. She can't save him on this one.
Congresswoman, if you were a gambling woman, which I know you're not, what would you say the odds are on Harriet Myers getting confirmed?
I think that even though the gang over on the Senate side who went in the back room and thought there would be no filibuster, thought that perhaps they were going to be able to kind of get this one through or backing up, the odds are that they can't get this one confirmed. This one is not going to work.
Do you think they ever thought that the reason they were backing up would be because of their own party?
No, absolutely not. I think that he thought that he had done enough for the right-wing conservatives, his own, you know, group that put him in office, that he could get away with this one and have his own because she had been so close to him. But I like seeing them fall apart.
Yeah, it's great. It's
great.
Right.
It is absolutely great. The covers are off.
Yeah, well, let's continue to talk about them falling apart on the subject of Valerie Plame. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that the special prosecutor is widening the investigation and that Judith Miller, as we know, spoken about a conversation she had with Scooter Libby back in 2004. Now, what do you think the chances are that Dirty Dick Cheney is knee-deep in this thing?
Well, first of all, we know Karl Rove is deep in it, and we believe that Dick Cheney is deep in it. It seems to me that they're going to get caught perjuring themselves if they're not careful, because a lot of conversation went on. We don't know everything that each of them has said to each other, but obviously they have been talking about how not to reveal exactly what was done. This business of Karl Rove is, I didn't mention any names, I didn't talk with anybody in particular, is not going to fly. I think that they're dirty, they're caught with the hands in the till, and somebody is going to get indicted.
Yeah, that conversation I was talking about, I just want to clear this up for myself, was in June 2003, not 2004. Yeah, that's and now Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, he's had his record subpoenaed by the Securities and Exchange Commission around allegations of insider trading. I mean, how much trouble do you think he's in?
Well, I don't know. You'd think he would have been smarter than he appears to have been. He should have stayed way away from any direction of investments or, you know, selling with this account. He's not supposed to know what's going on with his investments. And so it seems to me he's been a little bit too close. At first I thought there was nothing to it, but the more I hear, the more I'm beginning to think that maybe there's something here.
It seems to me, Congresswoman Maxine Waters, that the Democrats have a real shot in 2006 to get some congressional seats and some Senate seats, and it seems to me that there is a growing momentum starting in terms of, you know, getting candidates. What do you think some of the big platforms are? I think they're all sitting right here in front of us of what we talked about today, cronyism, corruption. What are some of the other thoughts in your mind?
Certainly that's going to play very big for 2006. It seems to me that it's not just one time delay, but it is spreading, and it seems to me it's from the White House on down through the House of Representatives. So there are going to be some opportunities there. But I think there are some other things that are playing well for Democrats. Just taking a look at how New Orleans and the Gulf region was handled in this great disaster reveals a lot. And they were in your face with the Halliburtons and the no-bid contracts. And I think people are fed up with that. They're beginning to really understand who these people are. You know, they're thieves, they're robbers, they're liars. I mean, everything from Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, which there are none, and the Halliburton thievery, I just think it's a lot there that can be put together to really, really cause the Democrats to be able to win. So I think the Democrats have to seize every opportunity to expose this gang in the White House so that the American people can know that it's not just them, that it is true, that that's who they really are.
Now, Congresswoman Waters, I wanted to talk about something else that has kind of flown under the radar. And you mentioned New Orleans a minute ago. I wanted to talk a little bit about this Gretna Bridge incident where a group of people, victims from Hurricane Katrina, were denied entrance to a predominantly white town across the river from New Orleans. And I know that some people in Congress have taken note of it. I know that Mayor Ray Nagin in New Orleans has taken note of it. What have you heard about it? And was it, from where you sit, an act of racism?
Well, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we have just about finished a resolution. John Conyers has gotten a letter signed up by a number of members going to the Justice Department. It was so outrageous that these people who had been directed by police officers from the New Orleans side to go across the bridge to Gretna, where there were supposed to have been buses waiting for them, and they were stopped by these sheriffs on the bridge who fired their guns over the heads of these women and children and told them to get back on the New Orleans side, that this was not the Superdome, they were not wanted, that they would only come over there and loot. They literally not only shot over their heads, they took their food and water away from them.
Wow.
Because they had put a little encampment up in the middle of the bridge.
Mm.
And so this is under the radar screen. A lot of attention is being given, even by the corporate press, on, you know, some of the other issues. This one got a little bit of attention, but we've got to bring this to light, because if, in fact, you can have the sheriffs or anybody, you know, police officers that are literally threatening people who are trying to get to safety in a situation like this, I think that this is worse than, you know, many of what many of us believe happened in slavery. And so we've got to do something about this. This is racism in its purest form.
Wow. Strong words. Thank you so much, Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Appreciate
you
being here.
Good talking to you.
All right. Great talking to you, Congresswoman.
All right, 16 past the hour. We'll be back with Sammy the Stem Cell. Sammy the Stem Cell after this. It's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
It's 20 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Morning Sedition.
Sedition.
Sedition. Is that the Jewish version of Morning Sedition? It's the atonement version for Yom Kippur. Hey, now to help us sort out some of the latest developments and issues surrounding stem cell research, we have a very controversial guest, Sammy the Stem Cell. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. everybody. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell.
So how are you, Sammy? What have you been up to?
You know, the usual. Pottery painting classes with my girlfriend. Yoga. Reading to the blind.
Well, that sounds nice, Sammy. I'm impressed.
Man, what a stooge. I've been huffing glue. I'll tell you one thing. After a couple of good inhales on these fumes, you'll be thinking you're painting pottery. You know what I mean? The kale munching recovery hippie.
All right. Let's just move on. Sammy, this week at UC Berkeley, the Student Society for Stem Cell Research held what they called a Nothing is Impossible candlelight vigil for stem cell research. What's your reaction?
Kids, glue is good for you.
Oh, boy.
It keeps your guts from falling apart. Glue's the bomb, yo!
Oh, man, you see, that's what I've been talking about. You're offensive and disgusting. Like that time you said you wanted to grow up to be Hitler.
Shut up! People love me! I'm sacred life!
Hardly, my friend. We just got this email from a listener in Alhambra, California, and I quote, "We still don't like Sammy. Are you listening? Pointing out that people don't like Sammy doesn't make for a good reason to bring him back. I don't want to hear him anymore. He wants to be Hitler. Can you not, please?" Well, what do you have to say for yourself, Sammy?
Seriously, Mark?
Mm-hmm.
It's all meant in good fun. I'm just trying to raise people's consciousness about stem cell research. If I've offended anybody, I apologize.
Mm.
You poot-headed sauce monkey.
Hey, wait a minute. That was real biggie to say. And it, what did you just call me a poot-headed sauce monkey?
Look, I don't write this crap, all right? You got a problem with me? Talk to my Jew writer.
Hello, everybody. I'm his Jew writer. Isn't that adorable? The little fellow wants to grow up to be Hitler. For as the Talmud did say, from little acorns, giant oaks did grow.
Now shut up, Ishtar.
Isn't that adorable? I told him to say that.
No, you didn't.
Now he's going to call me a filthy Jew, aren't you, little fella?
Oh, no, I'm filthy Jew.
Oh, boy.
Hey, I'm being controlled by the Jewish media.
There you go, little fella. Now tell all the nice people out there to huff some airplane glue.
Now, how can you, a Jewish person, mm-hmm. write this horribly anti-Semitic character?
Well, why don't I have my little friend Sammy give my explanation, keeping in mind it will be liberally peppered with offensive remarks and expletives. Mm. Sammy?
Well, Mark, we're simply using this as a device. You know, when you have a small, seemingly harmless character contrasted with the most brutally offensive remarks you can find, this naturally creates a comic effect, while also making the point that the sacredness of life is a more complex issue than simplistic dogma can allow. You lantern jaw hook nose.
You see, it's all for a good cause. I made him say that.
Bull! You don't control me!
I control my own destiny. Shut up! No, I won't shut up. Stop it. This is driving me insane. Look at him. Such a shin up on him.
Stop pinching my cheeks. You can't touch me.
I'm sacred life. Tom DeLay said so. Hole.
Oh, man. This is getting too freaky. I gotta get out of here.
Get out of my way!
Oh, man. Maybe you should get out, too.
Oh, screw you, hoodlum, and the horse you rode in on. You are not so tough. You.
Get out! I hate you.
Very well, I am leaving. But remember, I have been familiar with your wife in an intimate manner. Face.
Hey! You!
See you, pops. And have a blessed Yom Kippur.
Yeah, you too. Man.
You haven't eaten anything, have you?
Oh, except for the donut.
Oh, you had some of little munchkins in there.
Mark. Barry, when was the last time you fasted for Yom Kippur?
I'm fasting now.
Are you really?
Of course.
Did you go to temple yesterday?
No, I never go to temple. I just don't eat.
Oh, so this is it a dietary thing, or you just use this as an occasion to maybe watch the calories?
I think it's a good idea to not eat for a day. It breaks a habit. It helps purge the body. It helps focus the mind.
Has nothing to do with your sins?
I really don't know what my sins are, Mark. I can't isolate them. Most of my sins are against myself.
Did you read the script?
Oh, I helped write it. This is one of the things I'm atoning for.
He's atoning for Sammy. What do you have to say for yourself, Earl?
I just think it's kind of an offensive thing to be mocking people with hunger when there's so much genuine hunger in the world.
Did I do something wrong?
I don't know. Something got switched around on this.
I just feel duped and played by this non-Jew here. On Yom Kippur.
Uh-huh. Boy,
What?
On the holiest day of the year, we have to run this sketch.
Yeah. That's funny. We're going to get something about that. Yes, now, are you and Riley okay? Because there was some concern on behalf of some listeners that there might have been some tension before, but I can see that.
None but love. Nothing but love.
He's got a painting of you when you're 12. How does that make you feel?
Well, more of a photograph in his underoos. That's...
Oh, hey, how do you like that?
Underoos.
Underoos.
That's a funny word.
Hilarious.
That's a leftover reference from the 80s.
Did you guys use that one of your bits when you were a stage act? The underoos reference?
Yeah, we did, Mark. Yeah. Well, we were wiping the stage with your ass every night.
How can you do that? How can you do that when you're the opening act?
Because you were already drunk.
Touché, legs!
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, you're fired.
Fired? We never had a contract.
I can't do that anyways. I don't even want to go into that. So when are you going to... What? I got nothing to say to you anymore.
What do you mean?
Wait, Dan?
I was just telling you that the segment's almost over. Maybe we should tease the guest who's coming up next.
Who?
Oh, that's right. We got a great guest. Chris Mooney is the author of The Republican War on Science, is going to join us in just a few minutes. And there's some stuff going on.
Yeah.
The national... Well, I'll tell you in a minute.
Hey, get your hands off the book, Earl.
The City Bakery here, yes. 27 past. It's Aaron Michael Radio's Morning Sedition.
Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's, this is going to be good, folks. By the way, we're going to be at Florent tomorrow on Gansfort Street in the Meatpacking District. Freddie Ferrer is going to be there. Lawton's going to be there. My buddy Russ Maneev is going to be telling some jokes. We got Tom Beller, the writer. He's going to be there. But right now, whether the issue is global warming, evolution, or a variety of others, it's no secret that the Bush administration is trying to distort science for its own gains. Our next guest has a new book called The Republican War on Science that details just how and why this is happening. Chris Mooney joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Chris. How you doing?
Very good.
Good morning. Well,
thanks for coming down. So yesterday, a panel of experts convened by the nation's leading science advisory group warned that the U.S. was losing its competitive edge in science. Now, who is to blame for this? Is it has it been going on for a long time, or is it specifically this guy?
Well, the competitiveness problem actually is one that is pretty complicated, and I wouldn't necessarily blame that entirely on Bush.
A little bit?
Little bit,
okay.
Yeah, and on the stem cell area, we clearly are falling behind, and you can blame that a significant amount on Bush. But actually, the main issue that scientists are really worried about is competitiveness is one thing, but misuses, distortions, misinformation coming from the administration has really been outrageous.
So, not like everything else that they use to politicize or to use to political gain, they are cherry picking information or fabricating information from obviously the world of intelligence, but now a lot from science to justify their bad policy.
Exactly.
What are some of those policies?
Sure. Well, the stem cell area is a great one where the president stood up, said more than 60 lines will be available for research under my policy. Poof, there are no 60 lines. There are many fewer than that. And the president should have known because scientists immediately said, what 60 lines? That kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Just misinformation. It's something he should not have gotten wrong if he checked it.
Okay.
Global warming, they distort, they exaggerate uncertainty. They actually let people in the White House try to edit reports coming out of the expert agencies like the EPA. So that's pretty outrageous behavior.
Well, they've got oil executives and people that are obviously, have no care or concern for the environment in a real way in these jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I'm wondering, because I think it's a reach for some people to try and connect all of these different threads of science. People don't necessarily connect intelligent design to stem cell research to global warming to energy policy. How does your book kind of bring this all together? Because I think, if people think that there is some group conspiracy here, maybe they'll look at these issues differently.
Right. Well, actually, I think that's what my book does. There's been a lot of complaining about science being misused, but no big picture. The big picture, I think, is this. The Republican Party today has two key constituencies that are relevant for this discussion. Religious conservatives on the one hand, big business on the other. And they're different in many ways, but they both are coming into conflict with science. and Bush administration's bending over backwards to give them what they want on science. So fossil fuel companies want to challenge, in many cases, the risk of global warming. Religious conservatives want to attack evolution. They're both getting what they want under the Bush administration.
It's like that joke I do. I mean, I talk about that, is that you have one group that, you know, clearly is willing for the world to end, you know, the Christian conservatives, but the free market globalizers, the privatizers, the corporate economy, they're hedging their bets. They think that, that as bad as it gets, maybe that'll produce a new market to try and develop something to stop it, right?
Exactly.
But now, if are you from New Orleans?
I am. That's where I grew up. I wasn't born there, but
Well, so that's a, there's an interesting reframing of something. This was, you know, science has told us over and over again what needed to be done. Yet through, you know, intentional negligence, I believe these guys didn't do it.
Yeah. Or at the very least, you know, scientists were warning for decades and they were ignored. And then, of course, in the wake of the disaster, there's another form of expertise that's not specifically scientific, but it's emergency management expertise. And clearly we dropped the ball there as well.
For sure. Our guest is Chris Mooney. He's the author of the book, The Republican War on Science. Let's talk economics here for a minute, because one thing I think that happens is a government, depending on its ideology, can, you know, fund things in concert with its agenda, with its ideology, and withhold funding from organizations or agencies that don't agree with it. Did you see a pattern? Did you find a pattern of that in the book?
Well, there are some charges about that. So, for example, conservatives don't like Endangered Species Act, and one of the things that you do is, of course, you make it so the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't really have enough money to do its job, that kind of thing. But actually, I've mostly focused upon actual distortions of the information and less the funding side of things, because my feeling is that, to some extent, scientists do always want more money.
Well, yeah, they do. But isn't that all to the good? I mean, if the research is going to you know, establish scientific facts, shouldn't they get more money?
Oh, yeah. Scientists, I definitely believe science should be well-funded by government in this country. We have a long tradition of doing that, and it's produced really great basic research. But at some point, politicians do have to say, okay, enough's enough. We have other things to fund. But what politicians should never do is lie to us and mislead us, whether it's about the cause for war or the number of available stem cell lines.
Well, that's interesting you say lie, because that's clear to me, and they sort of stretch the truth and cherry-pick information, as you said. Is there any chance in your mind that somebody like George Bush, you know, actually believes that stem cell research is bad, that actually believes that global warming is not responsible, that pollution is not responsible for global warming?
Gosh, it's hard to tell what Bush believes.
But even Cheney, any of them. Why? I mean, obviously they are. I always wonder in my guts, it's like, these guys live here, unless they've got some secret other plan that involves leaving the planet or burrowing into the ground, what the hell are they doing?
Well, you know, Cheney is clearly in the global warming, either skeptic or contrarian, or at least inaction camp. And the president, who knows what he knows about this stuff?
That's true. That's true.
Good point. How deep is this ideology that we now see coming through? How far back does it actually go?
Well, I think it's part and parcel of the modern conservative movement in the United States, which is now running the Republican Party. But you can look back to Barry Goldwater running for president in 64, and the whole national scientific community opposed his presidency. And actually, they had much more political clout in 64 than they did now. But they attacked him for being dangerous with nuclear weapons. They thought he was going to lead us into a war with the Soviets, and that we're all going to die. And it isn't the same issue as the one today. Today, the issue is, you're lying, you're misleading us. Then the issue is, you're going to blow us up. But it is interesting that scientists attacked Goldwater.
Here's the thing that always kills me, and we talk about it a lot on the show, is that by pandering to religious fanatics who are willing to teach creationism in biology class as science, which in effect, they are basically, you know, denying their children a fact-based education and retarding them on some level, and I'm using that in the proper usage. How does that hook up to the fact that how are we going to remain competitive scientifically? Look, if you're a kid and your teacher says, hey, look, you can either do all this complicated homework about science, or you can just believe in God and say God did it. If I were a kid, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going with the God thing. So how are they going to motivate this competition you're talking about, where you have, you know, children in other countries that are chomping at the bit to get this information, and many of them are in school here?
No, I suspect that the misinforming of our students, which is now a lot of people are trying to make that happen, is going to have a long-term damaging effect on how educated a public we are, and that, of course, translates into, in a 21st century that's supposed to see great advances in biology and the practical application, biotech, You know, if kids don't understand evolution, that's clearly a big setback in that area. And it's something to be worried about.
Now, your book deals a bit with some of the advisory agencies, committees that advise different scientific agencies. What is the Bush administration doing in that regard?
Well, this is actually one of the topics that made scientists originally get so outraged in around 2003. A lot of reports that either people with strong ideological beliefs but not really the best scientific credentials are being put on these committees that are supposed to be comprised of experts who advise agencies on specific scientific matters, like advise the FDA about whether a drug is safe. And also that there were some charges that litmus tests were being applied. So someone's an expert in drug abuse, and they're being asked, did you vote for Bush? What are your views on abortion?
Did you vote for Bush?
Right.
And that is helping to establish your credentials about...
loyalty.
Oh, not drugs.
That's all that's important, yeah. Maintaining power, yeah, and and also the frightening thing is within these agencies, like in terms of epidemiology, or is that the right word, epidemics? Sometimes I make up words and I use them wrong. Histrionics was one I used wrong. But anyways, so what I want to know is that they stifle scientific research if it operates to support these corporate interests, even at the risk of the health of millions of people, like the whole meat industry thing and the mad cow disease issue. I mean, I have to assume that there's plenty of mad cow around, and science has sort of shown that in terms of the ratios that are possible. Now we have bird flu. I mean, what's going on with that? Are you keeping on top of that?
I am keeping on top of that one. Bird flu, I'm actually a little bit more hopeful, because unlike a lot of these issues, at least bird flu is not really politicized right now. So there's no one actually denying that bird flu is real. You know,
they can use it to scare people. They love scaring people.
Well, that might be, the danger might be on the other side, scaring people too much. But at least we're talking about the disaster before, unlike New Orleans, right? No one's talking, and then suddenly New Orleans is gone.
Except everybody that lived there. You lived there. You knew. You pointed that. Why is that boat up there? Oh, because that's water up there. Right? Am I right?
Yeah, but in New Orleans had a very laid-back, you know, don't rock the boat kind of ethos, the way that people, you know...
Yeah, because the water will come over the wall into the city if you rock the boat.
A little too much. Chris Mooney, when you talk about intelligent design, which I think may have been the Bush administration, certainly the religious rights, 500-pound gorilla in the room, it seems as though some of them, not all of them, but some of them are willing to try and reach some kind of an accommodation with science, with evolution. How do you see that turning out? I mean, do you think that 20 years from now, intelligent design will sit side by side in textbooks that kids are reading in this country?
Well, that if the intelligent design movement succeeds, it will be in a political way, and maybe they'll get into textbooks because they've achieved a political victory, but they will never achieve a scientific victory, and they will never displace evolution. And I say that because they're not doing science. They are postulating a supernatural being that is going around tinkering. You know, it's kind of like back when people used to look at someone who was having seizures and say that they're demonically possessed, or back when someone would say, oh, you see the thunder? That's the gods who are angry.
Isn't it?
I thought so.
That's what intelligent design is. It's God did it.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's not science.
I agree.
I think they do more than that. I think they tap into the idea that a lot of people just see things that they cannot explain through science. So they latch on to that little inexplicable thing and say, well, you know what? Science can't explain anything, everything. Mm-hmm. So what's left over that they cannot explain, this explains.
Well, that's right. They use it as an opening to propagandize their mystical belief system. I mean, that's what Christopher Hedges was talking about the other day. Mm-hmm. It's not that innocent. They're not just saying, I don't know. They're saying like, ha! Now you will deal with God, you know, and that's, you know, and that's like
a, the God of the gaps, they call it, actually.
Right, right.
God of the gaps.
And that's what the biologists who critique this approach call it.
Oh, wow.
And the gaps keep shrinking, and they keep trying to stick God in smaller and smaller gaps.
Smaller gaps. Yeah, see, progress is pushing God out. Do you understand scientific research?
Yeah, but if God is all powerful, he can always elbow his way back in.
Exactly. Where's that idea?
He can blow huge new gaps.
Exactly.
And then the whole argument there is like, is that the one thing that scientists are willing to concede is that no one has effectively explained why life persists. And why can't they just let it go with that? It's like, well, maybe there is room for spirituality in religion, but it doesn't have anything to do with science.
Sure, and that's the position that a lot of defenders of evolution actually take. There's this guy called Kenneth Miller, author of Finding Darwin's God. He's mm-hmm. one of the leading defenders of evolution. He's a Roman Catholic. You know, why can't we reconcile that way?
Yeah.
Why do we have to, you know, say it's either evolution or religion?
Is a Christian fascist movement in this country that wants to run it. Yeah?
That may have something to do with it.
All right, Chris Mooney, the book is The Republican War on Science. Really appreciate you being here. Good luck with the book.
Thanks, looking forward
to finishing it myself. It's 47 past the hour. We'll be back with Cliff Notes and some closing thoughts on today, the Day of Atonement. For those of you who are Jewish, it's time to cleanse that moral palate. We'll be back in a second.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Let's land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Man, hey, Democrats, look, we got a shot here, man. We got a shot here. The bottom line is that the true conservatives are starting to shift, and they are starting to shift for real reasons. They are freaked out about this Supreme Court nominee. They are pissed off at this president. They are pissed off at fiscal irresponsibility. They are pissed off at cronyism, at corruption. They are pissed off at the complete depletion and sucking out of the Reagan legacy. The time is ripe, folks. If conservatives are pissed off, liberals, progressives, and Democrats should get organized. You have an opportunity here. There's a lot of talk about the 2006 elections. There are 15 seats in the House that we need, 6 seats in the Senate. Now, get out there and make a go of it, somebody, anybody. Here's your chance, you know-it-alls and couch pundits. Take some action. Make a move. Run for office. If you're good-looking, charismatic, or just earnest, that's all you need, really. You know, pay some lip service to some good ideas. There's a million things we could point out. I dare somebody to run on bringing the troops home. How about that one? Where's that kind of courage? It's time. America's ready for it. How about pointing out corruption and cronyism at every turn? How about pointing out that Bush has bankrupted the country? If the conservatives are actually saying that, we should certainly be saying that. How about pointing out that the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, the FBI have all been turned out like cheap hookers for political purposes as opposed to legitimate security? There's a million things that people can be talking about and running on. I please inspire you. Please, I'm trying to inspire you. I would do it, but my past is way too dirty.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
It is. It is.
Oh, by the way, I just did find out, I just got this confirmed. C. Dolores Tucker, who was an anti-gangster rap activist, who, by the way, united with Bill Bennett. Now, yeah. She's African-American. She united with Bill Bennett and went after gangster rap in the mid-1990s. Was very well publicized. She just died.
Uh-huh.
She died at the age of 78. She fought for civil rights for a long time and did so quite nobly, and then got off into this gangster rap thing, sued Tupac Shakur for $10 million at one point. It was a very strange situation. But she was united with Bill Bennett in opposing gangster rap back in the mid-1990s.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah, well, sad to see, you know, sad when anybody dies.
Bill Bennett is no friend of the black people.
No, he's not. But he was C. Dolores Tucker's friend.
Well, you know, civil rights, there's another issue. Civil rights, still an important topic of discussion for Democrats who have the guts to talk about it. Poverty, still an important topic of discussion. Look, you know, there's a lot of progressives and liberals that have a lot of money that don't think civil rights is anything more than maintaining a good relationship with your nanny and making sure that she has a place to live and you pay for her doctor. It needs to be more than that. You know, this needs to be stuff that's not just based in shame of having money or in shame of actually being successful and being to the left. I mean, it has to come from a real place, or at least you have to be a good pretender. I'd settle for a good pretender, for God's sakes, just to get these seats back.
Well, I'll tell you what. People are going to have to get on the same page with their constituents. Every congressional district in this country represents approximately 587,000 people. You've got to get on. If the Democrats have any hope of retaking Congress, the party and its candidates are going to have to get on the same page as the people they represent.
That's right.
Do something for them.
That's right. And the thing is weird is that, you know, it's look, in a couple of weeks, hopefully at least 4 out of the inner sanctum, inner circle of this administration are going to be walked out of the White House in handcuffs, folks. Cuffs. Hands in cuffs. You know, and How could that not be a signal to say, look at them, vote for us? Even if we don't even have a vision, we've got a better way than that. And we do have a vision. You just find out, you got to figure out what it is and how to put it in your own words.
Yeah.
We know what it is. It's about all the things I just talked about. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Architects and planners from all over the country are meeting to discuss how to rebuild the Gulf Coast. On the upside, after the hurricane, most towns already have the traditional derelict vehicles ready to be placed on cinder blocks in front of every mobile home. Ooh. Historians say the region may be slow to rebuild, pointing out that Mississippi always opposed reconstruction. Yahoo is shutting down internet chat rooms that promote sex between adults and children. Yahoo agreed to reject chat rooms' names, which seem to encourage sex between adults and children. Bad news for people who truly want to just run an R. Kelly fan club. Many of the chat rooms' bad names, like Kitties Who Like Sex, Teens for Older Fat Men, and the oddly named undercover FBI agents who crave pedophile action. Man, that took a long time. Phrase of the day, just drop it into conversation, folks. Half of all Americans think Bush should be impeached if he lied. Wake up, sheeple. Nobody wanted Bill Clinton impeached, and they impeached him. Half the country wants this guy impeached. Nothing. Come on. Come on. What do we got tomorrow?
Tomorrow we're at Florent with Fernando Ferrer, Lawton Smalls, Cardinal Milfington, and so much more. It's been fun, Marin.
Yes, it has, Riley.
This is Air America Radio.